morning. It's Wednesday, July 9th at about 10:06 a.m. I'm your substitute host today. Shelley is out of town, Matt Newton. And boy, do we have kind of a mixed nuts episode for you. And by nuts, I don't mean just because we have Councilman Louis Vieira on the air, giving the thumbs up to the microphone. And also my good friend, Margaret Maggie Tassone, urban planner at Landis Evans. And we have a bit of a mixed nuts because it is the second week of July. And if you are a law nerd like me, you have plenty to talk about as most new statutes take effect July 1st, 2025 every year. And especially if you work in local government like I do and like Lewis does and Maggie, you got to be on top of the preemption madness that happens every year. And by preemption, I mean the state government taking control out of certain topics, out of the reign of local government and local government legislatures. So we have a lot of examples in the past, the famous tree ordinance from a few years ago, certainly uniform control of certain topics like guns back in the early 2000s, the uniform Joe Carlucci Uniform Firearms Act. We have a few preemptions this year. And listen, of all of them, I am most excited to talk about turf.
Bring it on.
So, listen, everything that's kind of going on right now in the state of Florida, I think, and I'm going to make a little challenge that I can tie back to turf and artificial grass. And you know, if any of you are doubting me, just say, hey, how does this relate to turf? And I'll tell you. So in the city of Tampa, for years and years, I will get calls from people saying, listen, I'm tired of mowing the lawn. I'm tired of the upkeep. I know I can do like a Florida-friendly landscaping thing, which, Google it, it's very interesting, but it can be very expensive. You know, and we're in a drought, it's expensive. I think 30% of water bills go to, like, just keeping grass alive. I mean, grass is the biggest crop grown in the United States. So let me get rid of it. Let me put some turf down. And so I would say, you know, that seems like a good idea. Just to throw some carpet down. Who's it going to hurt? It's good for water conservation. And then I did some research on it. Mm. And I talked to some friends. And it's arguably pretty bad for the environment. Mm. I mean, and flood control and all this kind of stuff. I mean, Maggie, what do you think?
Yeah, I think everything has to come down to the permeability of it. And, you know, how is it going to impact stormwater treatment? So, you know, if it's able to permeate into the ground, you know, it may not be an issue. But that's when you may have to step in and start to regulate what types of turf are going to be allowed and decide who is going to be the regulator of that.
So what is permeability? What does that mean for our listeners?
Yeah, to keep it simple, it's will the rainwater exit through the turf into the ground? And yeah. So it's as simple as that, and that's very important.
Especially if you have a dog. I mean, think about it. If you know, should you be able to just hose down your lawn and to your neighbor's lawn instead of scooping it up? I mean, I know it's the city of Tampa has allowed turf in certain circumstances, particularly with like commercial properties. I was living in West Tampa for years before I moved out to Dover, represent. And you would see it on a lot of like office commercial properties, usually in small amounts along the sidewalks. But it hasn't really been freely allowed in single family neighborhoods. And we have a lot of single family neighborhoods, and we have a lot of single family neighborhoods in flood prone areas of the city. So there is some reasonable concern amongst urban planners and law nerds. How is this going to affect flooding in areas like South Tampa and areas like your district, Councilman Vieira, and North Tampa? What do we think? I mean, I might be getting ahead of myself here because, and let me just say, the law doesn't say you can throw down turf. It's directing the Department of Environmental Protection to develop standards that can be used. And once those standards are used, which address things like permeability, you know, there's another standard I think that we should be considering, which is microclimate generating, because these things get hot. I mean, like 100 degrees above, you know, the surface of the sun hot. but these types of standards, and then once those standards are developed and set forth, from thence on, local governments cannot create standards that are more restrictive. So if you're listening and are like, yes, I can finally carpet my lawn, hold on. Mm-hmm. There's some time. There's some time before, you know, that might be allowed. But Councilman Vieira, you've had a lot of experience in flooding in your district and flood control. What are your initial thoughts about this preemption coming down the pipe?
So a couple of things. I recognized it for you, July. It's Christmas in July. As a law nerd, I don't know. I'm an attorney, and I don't know many bigger law nerds than Matt Newton. So that's a fact. So I just want to lay that out there.
Thank you, sir.
A compliment, man. That's awesome. Like, you really like this stuff, and that's awesome. Because a lot of lawyers are like, yeah, I'm just here, man. You're more than just here. So, you know, Your rights as a property owner and when you affect other people. And we see that a lot with development. So with turf, there is that balancing act where people do have a right to do what they will with their own land reasonably. But when you begin to have adverse effects on the environment that can be ascertained, but especially with flooding, that issue's become more acute in the city of Tampa. You know, we hear, and again, this is me talking about rumors. You got the town and country that was flooded last year after Milton. Mm-hmm. A lot of people say that it had something to do with the repaving that they did out there in town and country. Again, I don't know if that's true. That's just something that people say. I say that to say that there are often unintended consequences to things that may have no relationship to flooding upon initial scrutiny. And so we have to be very careful, especially in light of the terrible human devastation that happened last year, to not have those unintended consequences. People can do what they want to do. That's fine. But their rights end when you begin to intrude on the rights of others.
So that's a good point about the road, because, you know, when a planner sits down and starts planning, there's a series of premises mm-hmm. that they're utilizing, and a lot of those are based on the comprehensive plan yep. mm-hmm. and the land development regulations mm-hmm. that have been developed by the local government by directive of the state legislature through Chapter 163. And if you really want to be nerdy, you know, download it, read it tonight. It's exciting. But Maggie, as you're planning out a site with your team over at Landis Evans, flooding, particularly in Florida, and you know, grading and surface water management is always a topic of discussion. I mean, what kind of things can you imagine your team will be discussing if, you know, hey, this surface water management, you know, permitted through SWIFT MUD and everything, you know, do we need to think about turf being utilized? You know, I mean, we don't know how it's going to work, but is this going to be part of the permitting process up top? Are people going to have to talk to SWIFT MUD? I mean, I don't know. I'm like nervous and excited.
Yeah, and I think we won't know the effects until a year or 2 years down the road once this is implemented, because one of the biggest concerns you hear from neighbors when any new development comes in is, I'm going to flood. And I think right now we're looking at it at a small scale on an individual lot, single family lot, less than 1 acre. Right. But if everybody in the neighborhood has the turf yard, that's when the implications are going to come into place. And we really won't know what that looks like until it starts to happen. So a lot of times we're dealing with, you know, repercussions of a decision that was made. So I think we're looking down the road when that becomes apparent.
Yeah. I mean, and when you talk about public policy, you always kind of have to think about it in the aggregate. Mm-hmm. Because I agree, you know, one single family lot, you know, but neighbors will say, hey, that looks nice. You know, hey, I want to see what it's like to vacuum a lawn. You know, mm-hmm. You know, let me give that a try. You know, I'd like to try a different shade of green. You know, maybe could we have purple lawns, red lawns? You know, I don't know.
Somebody will.
I mean,
oh, yeah. Orange lawns.
And then there will be an amendment to this. So, you know, we got talking about flooding. This isn't necessarily a preemption, but I was very heartened to see the state of Florida kind of really stepping in when it comes to making sure that citizens are informed about the role of flood insurance in unowned property. Mm-hmm. Councilman, I know after Milton and Helene, there were a lot of discussions, particularly in you know, rented properties. I didn't know I needed flood insurance.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I didn't know I was in a flood zone. You know, I didn't know that my landlord wasn't required to have this. So, I mean, how do you feel about that?
Oh, it's great. I mean, that's a wonderful law that Tallahassee passed, fully supportive of it. The tragedy with Milton last year was that so many of the areas that were flooded were in Zone X, where people assumed they didn't have to have flood insurance. I'm in New Tampa, the Alaska of the city of Tampa, and I just got flood insurance because it's $400 a year. Might as well, right? So that's the tragedy of it. A lot of folks were in Zone X and go, I didn't know I needed flood insurance, and they're flooded. But to the extent that that helps with people who are in flood zones and need to be empowered with that information, again, that's a step in the right direction. Mm-hmm. That's a step in the right direction, obviously. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I do live in a flood zone, and you know, thank goodness my house didn't flood. And I feel like, you know, as a dork, I could probably make arguments that I don't need flood insurance, mm-hmm. and that was something that was kind of rolling through my head because it's not cheap, but it did give me some peace of mind.
Yep.
So you know, hopefully the legislature's intent, which is not to require it, but just to educate and yep. say, this might be something you should consider in mm-hmm. addition to renter's insurance, or even if you don't live in a flood zone, even if your mortgagee isn't requiring it,
yeah.
think about it, shop it around. It might not be too expensive, and yeah. it might give you that peace of mind the next time the storm is coming through.
Yeah, and it is. And again, depending on where you live, for me, it was a couple $100 a year, and that's, you know, every month that you go to Walmart, if you don't buy two DVDs or whatever, then you'll yeah. make that up. I'm joking, but you know what I'm saying.
What is a DVD?
I know, right?
I think last year was a real shell shock for everybody in the Tampa Bay area mm-hmm. because we might not have had to worry about these things in the past, but when you have two hurricanes hit back to back with, you know, devastating results,
yeah.
now you start to open your eyes and ask, you know, how do I protect myself in the future? Mm-hmm. Because this is a reality for us on this coast now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Councilman, speaking of protecting ourselves in the mm-hmm. future, and I know this wasn't on the topic list yeah. that I circulated earlier this week, kind of giving away the magic of radio. You know, we do some preparation yeah. despite what it sounds like. What kind of steps have the city of Tampa and Hillsborough County mm-hmm. been taking to try to harden themselves this hurricane season? Because it is officially
yeah.
hurricane time.
So, you know, the city of Tampa, a couple of things. For my district, the big issue was the pump generators, which is in North Tampa. A lot of the pump generators apparently either weren't there or weren't working. And so in the Forest Hills, North Tampa area, that was really on the mind of a lot of people. And that's true for the county, too. There was a pump generator on Fowler, which didn't work, which was county, Hillsborough County.
There's one across the street from my house that didn't work.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I remember that. And it's devastating. So we have that. You know, and then just a lot of everyday maintenance that is done. You know, I think that Black and Veatch study, which should be coming out within the next month or two, is going to be so important in terms of the master plan for what we need long-term in the county, whether it's Plant City, whether it's Town and Country, whether it's New Tampa, wherever, and to see how much we want to pay for supporting our infrastructure. Mm-hmm. We need to have that conversation, and we can't be political chickens about talking about that, even if it means more revenue. We need to have that conversation locally.
So, I mean, as this is kind of the Tallahassee Mixed Nut special, mm-hmm. Was there funding requested from Tallahassee?
So I know, for example, Hillsborough County had done a request for money for generators, and I have no idea why the governor vetoed it. $3 million. It passed. Next time I talk to him, I'll ask. No, I'm joking. But I have no idea why he vetoed yeah. it. It makes no sense. And there's no political basis for that. And this is something that empowers local communities. This is why we pay taxes for. And $3 million, when you're spending $500 million on a political stunt in Everglades, you know, $3 million isn't a heck of a lot of money, especially when it's going to help people not flood.
Yeah.
So, you know, that was a big disappointment, obviously. So, yeah, that was a shock. When I saw that, I went, why you got to do that, man? I don't get it.
Yeah, you know? I mean, it's so, I write a weekly column for mm-hmm. La Gazzetta,
yep.
and I did touch on the vetoes. There's mm-hmm. about $600 million yep. vetoed from the budget. And listen, that's yep. that's life in the big city.
Yep.
You know, that is, they have, the governor has the power of the yep. pen to veto. Mm-hmm. The legislature has the power of the purse. Mm-hmm. You know, the legislature also has the power of the override.
Yep.
So, you know, maybe that's the thing. But, you know, we do have a separation of powers embedded in our state constitution, just like in the federal constitution. Mm-hmm. Governor has the executive buttons. Legislature has the legislative buttons, mm-hmm. and the power of the purse. And then the judiciary, you know, is out there, mm-hmm. making sure the checks and balances are in place. You know, not a perfect system.
Yeah.
I mean, you can find lots of examples of that. But, you know, my point in this week's column was, like, listen, fair enough, power of the pen. The example I used was, I think, $300,000 for air conditioning in South Florida, because a lot of our prisons are not air conditioned, which I was shocked to learn. I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah, they're not,
And there's people that die from heat, you know, exhaustion. So there was this kind of this pilot program. Florida Politics had written a good article about it. And I just thought it was odd that a $300,000 pilot program, which would have benefited about 1,000 people, and not just the incarcerated, but also employees in the prison system and volunteers, could get some relief. And it was vetoed. But at the same time, you know, $450,000 a year tapped into emergency funding for the I don't want to call it alligator Alcatraz because it's just kind of
so juvenile,
but you know, the experiment, I mean, really is kind of a different type of pilot project going on down south, which, you know, in theory will be reimbursed through FEMA. I don't think anybody asked the federal Congress whether they wanted, you know, and it's not FEMA, but it's a different account. Yeah. Like it's you know, I don't know, which obviously, looking at what's happening in Texas right now, we need those funds available.
Oh,
we don't need them tied up. So it's like, you know, vetoing with one hand, you know, important flood infrastructure, and then just kind of snapping your fingers and finding funds to do things that weren't approved by the legislature. And, you know, one wonders if it would have, if it actually gone through the process. Would this had passed both the chambers of the legislature when, you know, the resources of the state are vast, but they're not unlimited.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I promise this wasn't the Matt Newton show. I just rambled on.
Oh, no. You're preaching to the choir with me. I mean, and if I may on that, I mean, you know, to build a facility in 8 days at a cost of, I think it was $450 million for something that is clearly being used for politics, clearly being used to prop people up in the on the federal and national level. And then the subject of the cruelest jokes where you're taking people, 60, or I've read, I believe it's about 60% of the folks there don't have otherwise criminal records. Many of them could be the people who were here on TPS that before January were legal and now are anything but. And making jokes about them being eaten by alligators. I go, where the hell is our humanity? It's wrong. It is wrong. It is wrong. Somewhere between this punitive cruelty and the no borders crowd is sensibility, compassion, and rule of law and law and order on immigration. And we are disowning that to our moral loss here in Florida.
On that note, station check. You're listening to WMNF Tampa. We're speaking, I'm Matt Newton. We're speaking with Maggie Tassone, from Landis Evans Urban Planning Extraordinaire, and your city councilman, District 7, Louis Vieira. So, reaching into the bag of mixed nuts here, let's talk about affordable housing. Have you ever heard of it? Everybody's talking about it.
Yeah.
I don't want to just jump into the Live Local Act because I know what it is. Maggie knows what it is. Lewis knows what it is. But I don't think everybody does. Mm-hmm. And so let's kind of go back to the beginning, that chapter 163 thing I mentioned earlier that you're downloading on your Kindle tonight to read. That sets forth, back in 1975, the Florida legislature was like, we're growing. Mm-hmm. We're growing quickly. Air conditioning is becoming affordable. People are moving down here. The land is cheap. We're having a bit of a land boom. But we need to control this because there's a lot of sprawl going on. There's a lot of abuse. There's a lot of premature subdivision. It's actually more interesting than it sounds. but we need to put some rules in place. So we of the Florida legislature order every local government, that's every county, every city, to adopt a comprehensive plan. And each comprehensive plan has to have certain elements. And I'm going to have my urban planner on call describe some of those elements.
Absolutely. So you have future land use, housing elements, transportation elements. In Hillsborough County, you have a water element. Mm-hmm. And so these deal with all the aspects of, you know, potential growth and development and what the county or municipality wants that to look like. What are the goals? What are the policies? And that kind of sets the stage for long-term planning.
Yeah.
And then you go down into zoning, which is more short-term.
Yeah. And so that's right, with zoning land development regulations, which are required by Chapter 163 as well. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like the comprehensive plan is the Constitution. And then the land development regulations are the statutes which execute on those goals.
Correct.
So, for example, going back to turf, and we did get an email that raised a great point about microplastics in turf. And there may be portions of the environmental element or the water element of the comprehensive plan that say, you know, discourage the use of artificial turf. And so the land development regulations might take that and say, okay, to implement that call of discouraging, let's say no artificial turf unless there's a special use approved by the zoning administrator and you show X, Y, and Z on why it's appropriate. So that discourages it. And so giving these powers to local government and the responsibility of planning has been a big thing. And over the years, these comprehensive plans have grown and evolved and incorporate, you know, particularly maps to show where the future land use is planning. And when there's future land use categories, Maggie, explain like what that means.
Absolutely. And so you can have a residential category. So in that classification, you can have different densities of residential development. You can have a commercial classification. And within that commercial classification, you can have various zoning districts, which permit different uses. Sometimes in the commercial, you'll be allowed a certain percentage of residential. Also very important, industrial classifications. Yeah. So within that industrial classification, you're allowed various zonings, which again permit different land uses. So you have these broad spectrum determinations of what land uses are going to be allowed in this area. And those are usually grouped together. So what they call compatible and consistent land uses are generally grouped in the same areas. And higher intensities and densities are more central and along collector and arterial roadways.
I'm glad you mentioned that.
Yeah, and then it decreases in density and intensity as you go out from there.
So, for example, you wouldn't want a IKEA with an access from a dirt road, you know, out in the middle of nowhere, where, but you would might want one on, you know, State Road 60 with access to the crosstown.
Exactly. And all of those elements come together to ensure that there's infrastructure to support that type of development, that intensity or that density. So it's very comprehensive and holistic approach to long-term planning.
So keeping all that in mind, that's kind of been the norm since 1975. A couple years ago, the state has kind of stepped in to the future land use category and said, listen, if you're going to allow the high intensity of, say, an IKEA on a piece of property, why can't we allow affordable housing on that piece of property as well? I mean, is that kind of the gist of the origin of Live Local Act? I mean, the spirit?
That's correct. And I think it comes with good intentions and a high level approach to it, with maybe not as much consideration to all the details as you go further into short range planning.
Yeah.
And start to really get into the nitty gritty of transportation, utilities, and what those impacts might be to the surrounding neighborhoods and areas that they're situated in.
I think I agree with you, and especially you had mentioned industrial. And Councilman Vieira, you might want to speak to this as well, because I do this for a living, a lot of the land use law. And something I've noticed early on, and Councilman Miranda constantly reminds me of, is that industrial land is an endangered species.
Yeah.
It's protected.
Yeah.
You don't rezone to industrial very often
yeah.
because it's situated in particular areas to protect, you know, residential neighborhoods. It's usually mm-hmm. put off to the side. It's put by mm-hmm. railroads. It's put by arterial roadways. So it's very interesting that was one of the first categories of land use to be incorporated into the Live Local Act.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and especially here in Tampa, a lot of the industrial land is clustered near the port, mm-hmm. which, you know, has beautiful views, but also like the American Southeast fuel kind of comes mm-hmm. through there. And if we start putting condos in there and creating, you know, potential nuisance cases, mm-hmm. you know, is that going to be good for our supply chain?
When you think about zoning, you have to, you know, the origins of it. So what is it? It's policing. And why do we accept it? Because it protects the health, safety, and welfare of the public.
Right. So, I mean, we've been having kind of this discussion, you know, for the last couple of years since Live Local Quebec came in, and it was kind of like, is it good? Is it bad? You know, a lot of people, you know, have been kind of examining it on how to utilize it, but the execution has been kind of clumsy. Usually, if you have a big project that might be suitable for a Live Local Act type experiment, you're going to need relief from parking, from, you know, other standards, which until recently, you know, weren't really available or was kind of unclear and how it was going to be done. Also, a lot of land in the city of Tampa and throughout the state of Florida are not zoned, you know, commercial. They're usually zoned planned development. And, you know, put on your fun hats if you want to talk about the history of PDs. I mean, I'm down for it. But but it was kind of clear, is this going to apply to these types of planned developments? And so, you know, July 1st, we got some guidance on the plan development question. We got some kind of guidance on the parking reduction question. But also, there's kind of a really interesting component that has been, you know, generating a lot of press, which is the yes in God's backyard question, which is permitting affordable housing on parcels owned by religious institutions and houses of worship, which I understand is kind of a movement that's been growing across the country. So why don't you give us a thumbnail of some of that, Maggie?
Yeah, absolutely. So now if a parcel of land is owned by a religious institution defined by the state, that land can now be used for affordable housing, a certain percentage for the AMI, average medium income, for duration of, I believe it's 30 years. Mm-hmm. So that opens a whole new can of worms and also an abundance of land. Truly, there's yeah. tens of thousands of properties that are owned by institutions. So now you have this issue with, you know, affordable housing. We did not have enough. And now you have another avenue to achieve that goal of increasing the supply to meet the demand.
Yeah, I mean, and it creates an interesting question. I know some religious institutions have been outspoken about how excited they are about this. Other religious institutions think it's kind of half a thing, or it's like, you know, now we have this ability, but like, what does it mean? We're not in the business of developing land. You know, how do we know if we're doing it right? How do we know, you know, we don't have the tools for it. And you know, if we're going to get the finance from it, we're kind of going into a brave new world that we're not used to. So, you know, that's a bit of a new, you know, a new horizon on the Live Local Act.
Business opportunity for consulting.
I mean, you know, but the consultants need a consultant at this point. You know,
yeah,
it's an interesting, but we'll see what happens with that. Mm-hmm. So reaching back into the bag of mixed nuts, let's see here. Oh, storm reconstruction. Mm-hmm. I'm looking at you, Lewis.
and go ahead, you were going to say.
No, I mean, so, you know, typically, you know, as we talked about, the development of land and long-range planning has always kind of been within the realm and exclusive power of local governments. But on the back of these devastating storms last year, Tallahassee is kind of pulling back on some of those rights, at least temporarily after a storm. So why don't we kind of talk about that a little
bit? I mean, so this statute appears to be a reactive measure, and I don't necessarily mean that in a bad way, to the recent storms that we had, where it disallows communities, and correct me if I'm wrong, from having essentially a quashing development after hurricanes and everything. You can call it a moratorium. We dealt with that on city council as a proposal and so forth. You know, it's funny, because talking about Live Local, when I see things like that, it's one thing to encourage development, but it's another thing to mandate, because you mentioned infrastructure. And on that, man, oh man, our local communities have failed on infrastructure. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we've really put ourselves out there. Take a look at All for Transportation. You know, we could go through that and the legal issues involved with it and the goodwill of leaders in trying to make that happen. But when it comes to infrastructure, I feel that a lot of times development sometimes is like, you know, my suit, I wear like 45 regular. And if I go, you know, I'm going to buy 44 regular because I'm going to lose weight.
I'm writing that down, 45 regular.
Oh, I know. But if I, let's say I go, oh boy, I'm going to buy 44 regular because I'm going to lose weight and get there, right? But if you don't actually lose the weight, you can't fit into the suit. The big problem with a lot of this development is, you go, okay, you can develop here, and it's the inference that we're going to build fire stations, we're going to build mobility, you know, we're going to have that infrastructure, and we haven't had it. Take a look at downtown and all the development we've had there. You know, 30 years ago, there was nothing in downtown after 5 o'clock but drunk lawyers. Now you have a whole city within a city.
Why did you point at me?
I know. We have a whole city within a city, and we still got the same fire station servicing all of our friends in Channelside that was there 20, 30 years ago. So on that issue, local government has failed. Sometimes good intent and legal issues come up. Sometimes just don't do it. That's my big issue.
Well, it's hard to do it with the way the revenue is allowed to be generated by local governments. Mm-hmm. And I didn't mean to bring this up. Ad valorem taxes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But, I mean, wake up, ad valorem taxes. It sounds boring, but it's actually very, very important that we understand how in our state constitution is set up, how local governments are allowed to pay for themselves. Local governments, unless the legislature says so, can't charge taxes. Local governments, you know, when it comes to, for example, parking, when you pay for parking, the local government has to reinvest those fees into parking-related things. Otherwise, it's considered a tax, and that's a no-no. Mm-hmm. And there's all these kind of gotchas when it comes to raising money to pay for fire stations, to pay for public safety. And in addition to, you know, the taxes that we're allowed to charge, you know, the fees that we're allowed to charge, but that have to be used a certain way. Mm-hmm. You know, impact fees, for example, that there's, you know, oodles and oodles and oodles of legislation and how those have to be earmarked and charged and used and credited and yada, yada, yada. But largely ad valorem taxes, which I did major in Latin from New College. So ad valorem, which means taxing by the value of the property, is how these get paid for. And what percentage is it, Lewis?
In terms of what?
Of local government, 20% of local government services are paid for?
Oh, yeah. It's a significant amount, and that's a big debate that some people in Tallahassee are trying to force on us, which is getting rid of property taxes, for example, you know, which is to me just, I mean, gosh almighty, to do that, the consequences of that to our communities would be devastating.
Yeah, I mean, and it's already hard enough to pay for the roads. Mm-hmm. It's already hard enough to get a fire station open.
Oh, yeah, sure.
It's already hard enough to do the things that we need to do. Mm-hmm. And to take away ad valorem taxes for, I think it was just single-family homes, but again, there's a lot of single-family homes in our community.
No.
And a lot of them, you know, will draw large taxes. So, you know, as you mentioned, there was kind of a tug of war where it's like, how are we going to give tax relief to the people of Florida? Because listen, everything's getting more expensive.
Yeah.
The governor said, you know, get rid of ad valorem taxes for single family homes on homesteaded property.
Yeah.
You know, which is a very, you know, targeted tax relief to certain people who own homes, you know, which is not everybody. Or what I believe the speaker wanted was a reduction in sales tax,
yeah,
which would apply for everybody.
Yeah.
But as a kind of a compromise, he said, let's study the ad valorem tax thing.
Yeah.
Because listen, you know, I know enough about ad valorem taxes to, you know, order in a restaurant. Mm-hmm. But I do wonder, because we have a lot of our bonds premised on the ad valorem taxing powers of local governments. What would that do?
Yeah.
So the mm-hmm. legislature said, let's have a study, which was vetoed by the governor, who said we don't need a study.
Yeah.
I mean, you know.
It's ridiculous. I mean, ultimately, again, I my position on that is mend it, don't end it. There's nothing wrong with talking about a higher exemption for people. Again, there's black and white, and then there's gray. You take a look at the gray of senior citizens with homes that they own that are paid off and so forth. You want to address those issues. I'm not immune to that. But to say that we're going to get rid of the means by which we fund our public schools, the means by which we fund our cops and our firefighters, And to potentially replace it with regressive sales tax, where Homer Simpson's going to pay a higher percentage than Montgomery Burns, even more so, that's wrong. And that's, you know, we're doubling and tripling down on bad policy here in Florida.
Well, let's open up the phone lines. 813-239-9663. Again, 813-239-9663. We're talking about new legislation that's hitting the books July 1st of this year. Again, you're listening to WMNF Tampa. This is Matt Newton speaking. We're here with Maggie Tassone, urban planner extraordinaire at Landis Evans, and your District 7 city councilman, Louis Vieira. So as far as the kind of the preemption on rebuilding mm-hmm. after a storm, it seems like after a year, local governments can't mm-hmm. tighten the screws or mm-hmm. order that no new development take place.
Mm-hmm.
And there's also kind of a slew of new legislation as well, and it's about letting people know what requires permits, what doesn't require permits, mm-hmm. how much do you educate somebody on what you need to apply for a permit, and how much does it cost, and what do you need to submit? Because suddenly everybody in these coastal towns had to become kind of a contractor mm-hmm. and figure out what do I need to do? Do I need to pull a permit to, you know, tarp my roof?
Yeah.
You know, and quite frankly, a lot of people don't know.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, I get a lot of hard questions, you know, from my family and from friends that'll say, hey, do I need to pull a permit to do this thing? And it's kind of like, well, you kind of got to call City Hall.
Yeah.
You know, it's not always published or readily accessible. On what you need to do.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it seems like, you know, some of these towns, you know, true or not, or at least there was the resemblance of, well, let's use this opportunity to put something new mm-hmm. on everything that fell down, which, you know, people who wanted to rebuild, you know, might not have wanted. So they had to rebuild mm-hmm. to new standards that were too expensive to do. And then they had to sell their property to a developer who was like, okay, let's put something else on there. So the government retroactively mm-hmm. to August of last year said any new development regulations that are stricter than before, void.
Mm-hmm.
You got to let everybody rebuild to pre-hurricane standards. You know, and oftentimes, you know, and again, you know, it is an intrusion on the powers of local government, but there's some good arguments mm-hmm. on just showing some forgiveness.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. Especially, you know, we have a lot of people, a lot of examples of folks that just couldn't afford to keep up. All right, we have Ken in Pinellas County.
Hey, good morning.
Hey, Ken, you're on the air.
Yeah, thank you.
What kind of mixed nuts do you want to talk about?
Well, I personally think, you know, on this ad valorem and property tax issue, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm personally in favor of eliminating it, or to some degree, right?
Sure.
You know, property owners pay a large percentage of the services that everybody takes advantage of. You know, when I look at my trim notice, you know,
mm-hmm.
and I'm assessed for the county transit, I'm assessed for, you know, homeless, I'm assessed for the health department, at some point in time, you know, we've got to dial that back. And so I'll hang up and listen.
Thank you. And for the listeners, the TRIM notice that Ken mentioned, it's an acronym for truth and millage, mm-hmm. which before the property bills go out every year, under Florida statute, you kind of get a warning on, you know, it's called the TRIM notice that says, this is what you're going to be taxed. This is kind of the most you'll be taxed because the local governments can still, you know, bring it down a little bit or, you know, work on it because the budget process is not fast. But you do have an opportunity when you get the TRIM notice to appeal to your value adjustment board. If you miss that deadline, you know, good luck. But it does kind of outline that. And Ken makes a point. It is very hard to own a property because it's like the price of groceries. They don't go down, you know, or they go down for a second and they go back up. And the legislature has done things. One of the things that you know, is not on the TRIM notice is your property insurance.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And so, and I'm glad Ken brought that up because the cost of owning a home, you know, the taxes are high. But you know what we're kind of distracted about is the efforts that, you know, to reform property insurance in Tallahassee. Because that was what we were starting to talk about. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then we started talking about ad valorem taxes, which is kind of like, you know, is this a rhetorical strategy to shift the conversation? Because if we're cutting ad valorem taxes, are we kind of in a way paying for, you know, property, or is it kind of a handout to the property insurance company saying, you guys can go, you know, keep doing what you're doing, because we're giving cost relief in this way. Please don't raise property insurance prices.
Yeah, pretty please.
I mean, your legal practice is kind of in the realm of insurance.
Third party, yeah.
So, and, I mean, you know more about this than me.
Yeah, and I'll tell you, and Ken, thank you for your thoughts, sir. We appreciate it a lot. You know, my view on that is, again, mend it, don't end it. I ask people who want to eliminate property taxes respectfully, what are we going to replace it with? Because you take a look at the things that property taxes pay. They pay for our public schools. My son went to public schools. They pay for our firefighters. You know, if you want to defund the police, this is a good step towards that. And for the record, because I had this used against me once, I'm not saying to do that. I'm saying, you know what I'm talking about. I'm not saying that. But in other words, if you want to support cops, right, you do it through property taxes. So, you know, that's the issue, which is what do you replace it with? I would suggest that the more reasonable route, which is going to address some of the concerns that Ken's talking about, is to have a higher exemption and then to have an inflation adjustment. It's right now, I believe it is $25,000. Why don't we inflation adjust it every year? Every year, that's a tax increase on people in inflation adjusted terms. So I think there are good ways to address the things that Ken is talking about, and also to force local governments to say, look, you know, you got a triple on that, but we're not going to give you a home run. Take care of your basic responsibilities, and maybe you don't need that, you know, that whatever, that $2 million park or whatever it is.
Widget.
Yeah, exactly. To force people to be a little bit more fiscally responsible. So again, the gray works in this debate, I would respectfully suggest.
Yeah, and I mean, what's going on with property taxes? What's going on? I was hoping this year to see something on the list talking about property taxes. I'm very disappointed.
Yeah,
we did get some code enforcement action though. Yeah. Amendments to Chapter 162. Look it up right before 163, which is the power of local governments to have. Well, let me rewind and Lewis, you're a history nerd.
Yep.
Once upon a time, there was a thing called municipal courts, and municipal courts dealt with municipal things.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then at some point, we got rid of all the courts and just kind of into one mega court, which not really two mega courts, the county court and the circuit court at the trial level. Chapter 162 said, listen, we don't want to clog county courts with code enforcement proceedings. You still have the right as a local government to bring things to county court, and many do. But you can also create code enforcement boards.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You can have a code enforcement magistrate. And here is kind of a menu of penalties to get people to mow their lawns.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And the point is not to punish people. It's to achieve compliance.
Mm-hmm.
And so sometimes, you know, we've seen over the years that the penalties mm-hmm. don't actually deter people from violating. Sometimes they will build it into the cost of doing business. So there were amendments to the code over time, such as if it's an irreversible violation, mm-hmm. like cutting down a beautiful tree mm-hmm. that you can't just replace, mm-hmm. There will be a bigger fine. Mm-hmm. And I was interested to notice this year that Chapter 162 is being amended to allow a bigger fine for intentional demolition of a historic building, which can be up to, I believe, 20% of the value of the historic. It has to be a building that's recognized on the National Historic, you know, thingy. Is that, is that the right word?
Yeah, it is. It is.
Registry. Yep. There you go. So, I mean, as a representative of local government, how does that make you feel?
No, I mean, that's a good thing, obviously, because if you, you know, do damage to a historically protected property that entails code enforcement, it allows for more severe penalties, and you want that. And you said it correct, which is you have some bad actor developers that take a look at some of these actions as the cost of doing business, which is we're going to cut down these trees, for example. We're going to do X, Y, and Z. We're going to get penalized by local government, whatever, 10, 15, 20, 30,000. That's just the cost of doing business, man. And that's not right.
Well, and you know, when it comes to land development, oftentimes, you know, and I say this till I'm blue in the face, the fees, the fines, those types of things, that just gets passed down to the tenants if it's going to be a residential thing. You know, there's a spreadsheet, and it's just like, okay, well, we'll raise the rent by X amount of dollars to eat the cost of knocking this thing down.
Yeah.
So hopefully 20% is the right amount. And again, local governments still have the power to go into county court and get an injunction if they know it's coming. Fun story. Wasn't fun for me. But I used to live in your district, if you recall. I live near Busch Gardens.
Terrace Park area,
And behind my house was a beautiful forest. And massive trees, beautiful trees. And I thought, you know, I don't own that property, but there's no road that's going to these trees. Like, I think these trees are going to be here for a very long time, because essentially in order to cut them down, you'd have to, you know, get a survey done, see what's protected, build a road if you're going to get a permit to build a house. And I was so naive. Because I was like, I didn't consider that people might just break the law. I remember Sunday morning, somebody was back there with like a construction equipment. I don't even know what it's called. It looks like a Tonka truck.
Good old days.
Just wiping out trees left and right, you know, falling on my fence. You know, a Sunday morning. And it was like, oh, you know, well, they must have a permit. When, you know, no.
Surely they do. Surely,
And so, I mean, it was really, really disheartening, and I just thought about it, and I was like, well, you know, they can't replant the trees, and he probably just thought, one, he wouldn't be knocking down trees behind the house of a land use lawyer, but also, two, you know, ultimately, you know, if I get fined, I get fined. And it's just the cost of doing business. And you know, the more tools that local governments have to dissuade people from doing that, the better, because most developers, I mean, they're kind of, you know, have taken on supervillain status. You know, I mean, every, you know, Scooby-Doo episode is about some old developer that's trying to turn the amusement park into a, you know, whatever. But
that's true.
But most people try to do it the right way. And, you know, it's just about knowing what to do and putting, you know, penalties in place that, you know, the it's like water physics. Is it easier to do it, you know, the wrong way, or is it easier to do it the right way? As long as we make it the latter, it's easier to do it the right way, people will do that.
And you got to make it accessible to people and everything. But yeah, it's I hear you on, you know, living somewhere and looking at the property behind you and being very naive about it. I'm a very naive person, so I get that.
Let's talk about that.
Not now.
But I think people miss why it's important to protect, in this example, the historic district. Historic areas can be economic engines. So the local government has a vested interest to ensure that those historic buildings are protected to keep, you know, people coming to that area to keep tourism. So I think that's an important point to touch upon, too. You know, why is it so important to protect these historic buildings, to protect these trees, and make sure that, you know, there is enough deterrence to continue to do that?
That's an excellent point,
and,
Maggie.
And one thing I'd be remiss if I didn't bring up, because Councilwoman Gwen Henderson passed on not too long ago, and she would always talk about historical preservation and go, how come there's not any historical preservation where Black folks lived? You know, which is that we a lot of times in a lot of communities, we overlook that. And I would be remiss if I didn't give a shout out to something that the late Gwen Henderson would say a lot, because that's very true. Mm-hmm. That's very, very true.
Yeah, I was talking to a friend of mine yesterday who's an urban planner. And he had, because there was some discussion about the Marisol on Davis Islands, and I don't talk about it because I know it's probably it's a quasi judicial thing, but I was surprised to learn that it's not on any kind of national historic register. Yeah. And my friend had also pointed out that some of the remaining homes from the Scrub, which is a historic Black neighborhood in the city of Tampa, were also not on on any kind of register as
and
well.
And all those areas, I mean, so much of East Tampa is really just a historical area where so many remarkable things and remarkable people lived. I know I once found the childhood home of Robert Saunders, who was the head of the NAACP here after Harry T. Moore was murdered in Mims, Florida. It's been paved over, but there's nothing there. Mm-hmm. You know, we do a really bad job of preserving our Black history, and that's for another discussion. But again, given Gwen, I'd want to mention that.
And as Maggie pointed out, you know, what an opportunity when you have these historical assets to build around them and to leverage them into something that's unique. Yeah. And that's not just, you know, any other city, any other part of the United States where you just kind of have a one-size-fits-all architectural footprint that you just squeeze into a box where, no, here's a historic structure or a structure that's beloved by the community.
Yeah.
How can we make this something that really reflects? And guess what? A lot of what Maggie said is in our comprehensive plans. Read them, people. And don't preempt them unless you have a good reason. All right. Well, we're approaching 11 o'clock. Did we miss any nuts? Any? What do you guys want to talk about?
Anything you'd like?
Well, Matt said that he has other friends that are urban planners, so that kind of hurt me.
Okay. Listen, I made it up. I don't have any friends. So, I mean, kind of winding down, listen, there's a lot of new legislation that passed July 1st. This is just a snippet. These are just things that kind of jumped off the page to me as a local government nerd. But take some time, you know, to familiarize yourself with what's new, what's coming down the pipe.
Yeah,
I mean, there was a new, you know, not just what's being reported on, but things that just kind of slip through the cracks. Yeah. I mean, our local media are great stewards of making sure that we are informed of what's important.
Yeah.
But we also have a civic responsibility to educate ourselves and kind of take a look and peruse through. I mean, there's been reports about the new super speeder law, which I find interesting, was it 50 miles over the speed limit or over 100?
Yeah. And somebody who's doing that, I mean, hell with them, right? You know, I mean, that's just weird. But yeah, I mean, in Tallahassee, there's also the things we don't talk about, that we don't see, I should say, in Tallahassee. We don't see efforts to improve our public schools. We only see efforts to privatize our public schools. We don't see efforts to insure more people. If we were to accept when it was there, federal Medicaid expansion money, we'd have over 500,000 people in Florida get health insurance. So, you know, we don't deal with the human condition enough in Florida, and I just wish our public school teachers had as big of a bullhorn as the turf people apparently do in Tallahassee.
There, you tied it back.
Yeah, I know.
You tied it back. Full
it all
circle.
Leads to turf.
Hello. All right. So, good point. Good passing message. Don't look at what's been passed, but also what's not been passed. That's a message from Councilman Vieira. Well, I want to thank our guest, Maggie Tassone. Thank you so much for joining us.